I wanted to do two things this evening. One is continue in a sequence of verses I'm reading from in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then the other is something contemporary. You'll see how they fit. We'll be reading from Canto 3, Chapter 21, verses 9 through 11. And the chapter is entitled Conversation Between Manu and Kardama. The Manu being referred to is Swayambhuva Manu, and Kardama Muni is one of the direct initial sons of Lord Brahma. Where to begin? To give a little background, there are two places in the Srimad Bhagavatam that describe, in this Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 10 topics that are presented or discussed. And two of them are related to creation, Sarga and Visarga. Sarga, keep it real simple, it means what Lord Vishnu does. And this Sarga is what Brahma does. What does Vishnu do? The periodic cosmic annihilation, resting for some time, and then again the sending forth of the creation, maintenance, withdrawal of that creation, resting for some time, and then again creation. So Hare Krishna. That's your son, right? the Vedic picture of time is cyclical, just like it's trying to decide whether it's the end of spring or the beginning of summer. It gets sometimes very cold, and then again it's warm, then it's cold again. So it's, and so after spring comes summer, and after summer comes fall, and after fall comes winter, and they cycle. That's within our practical experience, the changing of the seasons. Similarly, the whole, take anything that has to do with time, and the Vedic picture of time is it's cyclical. So the ages of mankind, Satyug, Tretyug, Dwapayug, Kaliyug, they're cyclical. And then there's cycles within those cycles, and there's 1,000 of those makes a day of Brahma, and then there's a night of Brahma of equal duration, and he lasts for 100 years, and then there's cosmic annihilation. Within those, the days of Brahma, at the end of his day is night of equal duration to his day, and there's a partial annihilation. So in the morning, when Brahma wakes up, does his sadhana, then it's time to what? To recreate that portion of the universe that was dissolved or destroyed at the time of partial annihilation. And then at the beginning of his day, there are things that start to happen, like the Manus appear. The first Manu, and then there's 14 of them, and that's 1,000 of those makes one day of Brahma. So it's like just it's smaller circles, bigger circles, bigger circles, bigger, and then there's eternal time. That's discussed in this Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a chapter. I'm fascinated by the topic of time, so excuse me, but there's a whole chapter that discusses time all the way from eternal time to the smallest unit of temporary time. The smallest unit of temporary time is the time that it takes for the sun to cross one atom. That's the smallest unit of time. And then so many of those make another unit, and so many of those make another unit, and then you get minutes and your seconds, and then minutes, and then days, and weeks, and months, and years, and, you know, yuga cycles, and days of Brahma, and a half a day of Brahma, and the other half a day of the Brahma, and that's the creation, and then so many creations, and then it takes you to eternal time. Because actually, time is eternal. But in order to have creation, you have to have the other kind. Like, you know, this illusory kind. Where it seems like there's past, and there's present, and there's future, instead of eternally present. Anyway, it's fascinating. So, in the beginning of this canto, there's a meeting between Maitreya and Vidura. And the meeting between Maitreya and Vidura was told about by Krishna before the meeting happened. Krishna was speaking his final words before he finished his pastimes. He was speaking to Uddhava, what we know from the 11th canto as Uddhava Gita. But it's spoken about in the 3rd canto. The conversation is not presented in the 3rd canto. That's presented way over in the 11th canto. But Krishna speaking to Uddhava and hearing immediately in the immediate presence, like at Krishna's lotus feet, is also Maitreya. He hears Uddhava Gita spoken by Krishna. And before Krishna leaves, concluding his pastimes, he gives some service to Maitreya. He said, very soon, my very dear devotee, Vidura, will come to this very place in 2 or 3 days. He'll come right here. Because Krishna is omniscient, he knows before things happen what's going to happen. Vidura is going to come, and I would like you to instruct him in the same messages that I've been instructing here. So when Vidura comes, he doesn't see Maitreya, he sees Uddhava, and he has some discussion with Uddhava, and Uddhava says, Krishna wanted you to be spoken to by Maitreya, he went that away. Follow that away, and you'll find Maitreya. And he finds Maitreya. And Maitreya is very happy to see Vidura, just as Krishna said would happen. They appreciate one another's qualities, because in order to transmit transcendental knowledge, you have to have a qualified person. And to receive it, you have to have a qualified receiver. As in a very important understanding within the Bhagavatam is, what do we need to do to be a proper receiver of the Bhagavatam's message? And if you're going to, having once received it, what is your qualification to transmit it properly? Very important. Not just a technology, it's a quality consideration. So, their conversation begins, and Uddhava is being appreciated by Maitreya that he's very dear to Krishna. Krishna thought of you just before he left this world. He thought of you, spoke of you, and he wanted to give you something. You're very dear to Krishna. And Krishna is very dear to you. So you're a very special personality, and I'm very fortunate to have you, have your association. And the questions that you're asking are also very wonderful. The question that he started speaking about, the Krishna Katha that he wanted to hear, was about something that's a little difficult to hear. But it was creation. He wanted to understand how the Lord, how he does it. So there's long chapters describing one of the 10 major main subject matters of Srimad Bhagavatam, Sarga, what the Lord does to bring about creation. And then, having completed that discussion, there's then the arrangement for Lord Brahma, because he appears as Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, enters into each universe, and details, long, long detailed description. Brahma appears. And then there's like a little time out because it's the beginning of creation, and the first demon, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha are introduced. But to precede that, there's the first born of Lord Brahma. That's the four Kumaras. The four Kumaras go to Vaikuntha, so we got a description of the kingdom of God. Do you know any literature in the world that gives a description of the kingdom of God? It sounds like a nice place, you should want to go there, but there's no travel literature describing it except the Bhagavatam. So the Kumaras go there, they're checked by the gatekeepers. Gatekeepers are cursed. They become Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. And Hiranyaksha is killed by Lord Varaha. There's a whole description. And then it goes back to, okay, now what did Brahma do next? So that's, and specifically, what about the Prajapatis? Because after you have a universe, you have to fill it up with population of various species. You know, so the Prajapatis Lord Brahma also has a very difficult task, because he has to create all the different modes of nature or forms of life to accommodate those living entities that are moved by the lower modes of nature as well as the higher modes of nature, and he has to do that. He doesn't like doing it. And the way that it happens is also like, it is described. It's a little challenging for Lord Brahma. Anyway, because the living entities during the cosmic annihilation or the night of Brahma, the condition of the living entities is they're in this state of susupti, which means deep sleep. According to the Vedic literature, there's three states of consciousness: awake, sleep, and deep sleep. And deep sleep is like being anesthetized. Anybody had anesthesia before? What's your sense of time when you're under anesthesia or you come out of anesthesia? There's no sense of time. Yes? He's medical. I had some procedure. When you get older, you're supposed to have some things checked, and so some procedures. I'm lying there in the you know, place where they have the procedures done, and you know, the nurse that comes along that says, okay, you're doing pretty well, now we're gonna, you know, so she just changed the tube from this one to that one and said, count backwards from 10. You know, I remember getting as far as 8. And then something happened and I woke up and I thought, you know, when are they going to take me into this procedure room? Because there was no sense of passage of time, in other words. And I looked around and they said, well, you're doing pretty well. I said, well, you know, are you going to take me in to do the procedure? And they said, it's over. I looked at the clock. It's not like when you sleep and you wake up. It's a different kind of experience of consciousness. And I was discussing this with Prithu Shrava Prabhu. It's anecdotal, but it's something about how time works. Do you know Prithu Shrava Prabhu and his wife, Donna Kelly? Some of you do. So, okay. He's a Prabhupada disciple, very Brahminical personality. His wife also, they travel around in a van. They have no children. They travel around in a van and visit colleges and distribute books and conduct programs and meet students and like have a nice time. For a while they had a college center and University of Illinois, and you know, it was, they're just like very, very brahminical, nice devotees. Very nice devotees. Very, very, very nice devotees. So he developed a problem in his throat area where there was a tumor. It wasn't cancer. It wasn't like dangerous, but you know, it was a tumor in his throat. So he tried different things, natural things, this and that and the other thing. It didn't get bigger, didn't go away. It went on for a couple of years and then started to get bigger. So he had to do something. So he had to have, you know, found out where he could get it removed. So, put him under anesthesia, and then removed the thing, and then as he was coming out of anesthesia, he doesn't remember this, but the doctors told him that he had swallowed fluid or something, and so he started to cough, and so they put him, you know, again to sleep under anesthesia. So, he was under anesthesia for about a little more than 24 hours, which was kind of long, but, you know. And then when he came out of anesthesia, he told me, other than the pain and, you know, from where the incision was, he was wondering what happened. Anyway, it's hard to describe it unless you've been through the experience, but it's not like time has passed. It's another kind of, you know, time working in a different way. As like when you're asleep, like you can be, I don't know exactly how it works, but moments can pass when you're dreaming and it seems like, you know, hours. Anyway, time works differently according to different states of consciousness, and those living entities that are in, during the annihilation period, they're in this susupti state where the time energy has been withdrawn, and as a result, karma is checked. It's not zero, but it's held in abeyance. It's suspended. Time isn't happening. Activity isn't happening. Reactions to activity isn't happening. Consciousness is minimalized. The soul is still there, so the soul is still conscious, but so everything just stops. Like, stops completely. The modes of nature stop acting. Now it's time for creation again. The time energy starts. And so the time energy then activates the undifferentiated pradhan, the totality of material ingredients that aren't yet separated, and then they separate out. Starting with our dear friend false ego, it comes first. And then the modes of nature interacting with false ego make different things. Then they have the whole big warehouse of all the elements, and then Brahma puts the elements together and makes bodies and planets and forms of life. So when karma awakens from that dormant state, it's like, but it's also different than, when you're asleep. When you're asleep, some other activity goes on in your dream, in your sleep, and when you wake up, it's, oh, I'm Mr. or Miss so-and-so, and I've got to go to school or go to work or do my duties, and then you resume those duties. Something like that, only a little different. When the karma of the living entity, which was in abeyance, is now awakened, then it needs to be resumed according to wherever it was when the cosmic annihilation took place. And so there's lower life forms and the modes of ignorance, mode of passion, mode of goodness. The whole range is constructed by Lord Brahma. Those who assist in that service are the Prajapatis. Prajapati is a post. And Brahma himself is a Prajapati, and some of his sons are Prajapatis, and some of their sons are Prajapatis. Praja means offspring. Pati means the father of offspring. They produce offspring. like lots of offspring. And so Vidura asks Maitreya, what happened next? This is like after Lord Varaha kills Hiranyaksha, because that was one of the giant Vijay recurs to become demons, and so that happens. This is in Satya Yuga, at the very, very beginning of creation. Ravana and Kumbhakarna come in Dwarpa Yuga, and Shishupala and Dantravakra come in, that's Treta Yuga, then Dwarpa Yuga. So this is just still way at the beginning of creation. So Vidura asks, what happens next? So now what we're reading is what happens next. Swayambhuva Manu appears directly from the body of Lord Brahma. No help from his wife, directly from his body, because he needs a Manu. He needs a like a quality Prajapati to help him. And so from his own, so the first is the four Kumaras, and then Lord Shiva, and then come 10 great sages, and actually the list is 10, but then there's an 11th listed, and one of those 11, the 11th that's listed is Kardama Muni, because he's mentioned here. And after those 10 sages come the Manu, Swayambhuva Manu. And it's pretty cool. He's just like, boop, there's Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. And they're not like little babies, they're adult, ready to go. Well, you got some service for us. Yes, I need some assistance here. Make some laws for all the population that's going to be produced and help to produce population. So it's, yes sir, we'll get right to it. And it says at the beginning of this chapter 21, it indicates his two sons and three daughters. That's just the beginning. The two sons, we hear about a great deal in this canto and in the next canto. His first son is Priyavrata, and the second son is Uttanapada. Uttanapada is the father of Dhruva Maharaj. So that whole narration is part of that's another topic, the lineages of kings coming from the Manus. That's another one of the topics of the Bhagavatam. So it's kind of unfold. It's like you've seen a picture of a flower unfolding in slow motion camera. That's what the Bhagavatam is. It's just, it's not linear. It's like organic. It's very, very beautiful. If you know, once you become familiar with the topics of the Bhagavatam, it's very, very beautiful. And Krishna's in the center. The message of Krishna is unfolding as the message of the Bhagavatam is unfolding. But Maitreya chooses not to speak about Uttanapada and Priyavrata first. He chooses instead to speak of the daughters. In fact, that's what Vidura is asking. Vidura asks about the daughter Devahuti and Prasuti and Akuti. How did they increase the population of Praja within this creation that Lord Brahma has made? Because that's part of the creation. Is filling up the empty space with planets and living entities inhabiting those planets. So Maitreya is very pleased with his question, and then he starts describing Maitreya and his qualification, and Devahuti and her qualification, and he describes that Maitreya is a Mahayogi, and the Sanskrit of the verse says she's a Yoga Lakshana. We'll find out later as the story unfolds, but he had mystic powers that were very extraordinary. But he wasn't just a mystic or a yogi. He was a pure devotee. He was a pure devotee that directly saw the personality of Godhead. And his wife, the arrangement was made by Swayambhuva Manu that his daughter, Devahuti, was entrusted to him as her husband. And she was also qualified with perfect in yoga practice. They weren't ordinary personalities. But so then he backtracks and says that when Maitreya was requested by Lord Brahma, "My dear son, please assist me in creating good praja." The answer was, "Yes, sir." And the first action that he did was he took out a 10,000-year sabbatical to qualify himself to produce good praja. And like anything, like, you know, supposing you want to become an architect, or you want to become an engineer, or you want to become a doctor, or you want to become a lawyer. Okay, then you just like sit down and become a lawyer? No. You want just sit down and become a surgeon? No. There's lots of preparation and study. So for quality spiritual activity, like producing good offspring, you know, people get married and they have children. The biological process is easy. You get a marriage license and you go produce children. But to produce quality children specifically, it requires qualification, like spiritual qualification. So Kardama understood that because he was a quality person. So the duration of life in Satya Yuga is 100,000 years, and each successive yuga diminishes by a multiple of 10. What's 100,000 divided by 10? 10,000. And 10,000 divided by 10? 1,000. 1,000 divided by 10? 100. So that's the duration of life of the four yugas. 100,000, 10,000, 1,000, 100, and counting down. According to the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 12th canto, as Kali Yuga comes to a close, a person who is in their 20s will be considered a ripe old man. Which means most people don't live that long. But previous ages, life was longer and longer and longer. So he was, out of his 100,000 year, say, expected lifetime, one-tenth. So it's like if you're someone said, okay, would you like to become married and produce quality children? If the answer is yes, then you take 10 years to qualify yourself before you get married, before you produce children. Because the assignment is not just biologically reproduce, but produce good children. I'm just making the point. It's not, okay, the message is before you get married, spend 10 years of going to the forest doing some austerities. But understand there is some qualification necessary and some preparation to make oneself qualified, spiritually qualified, to be able to take on such an important service. That's Vedic culture. And how people apply it today might be a little different than Satya Yuga, but the principle doesn't change. You have to qualify yourselves. You have to qualify yourselves. So Kardama Muni, receiving this order from Lord Brahma, he went to the forest. Of course, most of the place was forest at that time, but weren't cities. Went to the forest by the bank of the river Saraswati, and he performed the Yuga Dharma. What's the means of achieving spiritual perfection in Satya Yuga? What's the means of achieving spiritual perfection in Satya Yuga? Meditation. Meditation. Dhyayate. Krittaya. So but by performing meditation, Prabhupada explains, it's not that he just meditated on nothing. He meditated on the personality of Godhead Vishnu and other forms of devotional service, because he became a perfect devotee. So Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, in order to fix the mind upon the personality of Godhead, the process of hearing and chanting was also part of what he did. Or in Satyuga, persons didn't just sit and meditate, they also engaged in the other processes of devotional service that assisted them in fixing their mind upon the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu. And he achieved, the Bhagavatam says, Maitreya says, he achieved perfection. 10,000 years. He achieved perfection. Now that's the background. I'm going to read the three verses where in that stage of perfection, the personality of Godhead, Vishnu, who he was meditating upon, became very pleased and appeared before him. It's something like Dhruva, because it's like time-wise, they're contemporary. Because Dhruva was the son of Uttanapada. Uttanapada was the brother of Devahuti. And Devahuti, the wife of Kardama Muni. So they're contemporaries. The process was the same, or quite similar. Meditation, fixing the mind upon the personality of Godhead, and suddenly he appeared right in the middle of the forest. And the paintings illustrating this are really nice. He's just sitting there in this idyllic setting by the bank of the river Saraswati, and there's the personality of Godhead standing in the air, riding in the back of Garuda, who's slowly moving his wings, and the Lord is smiling and looking very peacefully at Kardama Muni and the scene where Kardama Muni is. Here's the Bhagavatam description. Kardama Muni saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is free from material contamination, in his eternal form, effulgent like the sun, wearing a garland of white lotuses and white lilies, and water lilies. The Lord was clad in spotless yellow silk, and his lotus face was fringed with slick, dark locks of curly hair. No purport. Adorned with a crown and earrings, he held his characteristic conch, disc, mace in three of his hands and a white lily in his fourth. He glanced about in a happy, smiling mood whose sight captivates the hearts of all devotees. A golden streak on his chest, the famous Kastuba gem, suspended from his neck, he stood in the air with his lotus feet placed on the shoulders of Garuda. Pretty ecstatic. Imagine if you went off for a walk in the forest and saw Lord Vishnu like this. You have to be qualified first, not just a walk in the forest. I'm going to read the purport. The description in verses 9 through 11, which I just read, of the Lord in his transcendental eternal form are understood to be descriptions from the authoritative Vedic version. These descriptions are certainly not the imagination of Kardama Muni. The decorations of the Lord are beyond material conception, as admitted even by the impersonalists like Shankaracharya. Namely, Narayana, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has nothing to do with the material creation. The varieties of the transcendental Lord, his body, his form, his dress, his instructions, his words, are not manufactured by the material energy, but are confirmed in the Vedic literature. By performance of yoga, Kardama Muni actually saw the Supreme Lord as he is. There was no point in seeing an imagined form of God after practicing yoga for 10,000 years. The perfection of yoga, therefore, does not terminate in voidness or impersonalism. On the contrary, the perfection of yoga is attained when one actually sees the personality of Godhead in his eternal form. The process, almost done. The process of Krishna consciousness is to deliver the form of Krishna directly. The form of Krishna is described in the authoritative Vedic literature, Brahma Samhita. His abode is made of Chintamani stone, and the Lord plays there as a cowherd boy and is served by many thousands of gopis. These descriptions are authoritative, and a Krishna conscious person takes them directly, acts on them, preaches them, and practices devotional service as enjoined in the authoritative scriptures. Because we're very fortunate. We're very fortunate to have this wonderful transcendental literature describing the personality of Godhead. Like I mentioned, this other description of the kingdom of God. But now here's the Lord of that kingdom, and he's descending to this plane for the benefit of his dear devotee Kardama Muni. And to hear these descriptions is as fortunate as Kardama Muni seeing the form of the Lord. The emphasis that Prabhupada is making in the purport is these are not imagination. They're not stories. It's not some hallucination or something made up, because previous verses speak like that. There are impersonalists that say, and I've heard them say it, where these forms are imagined and they're to assist one who doesn't have the capacity yet to then enter into the formless. Directly, that's the teaching of Shankaracharya and the process of worship that's accepted by the impersonalists. The purpose of worship is to go beyond the form into the realm of the formless. That's not, because we read Prabhupada's books, we know the difference between impersonalism and personalism. But persons that have not read Prabhupada's books don't know the difference. And I want to share with you a little bit that's like the practical part. It's anecdotal in one sense, but it may help you in your presenting Krishna consciousness to others. So a little background, two things. I first met Srila Prabhupada at a university campus. He came to the university where I was a student. I didn't know who Prabhupada was. I didn't know up from down. I didn't know left from right. I didn't know anything. I just happened to pass by the student union when Prabhupada was giving a lecture and chanting Hare Krishna with Allen Ginsberg at the student union. I didn't know about it. I just happened to be there. And my life changed. Didn't happen all at once, but my life changed just from that contact with Prabhupada. It's very clear in retrospect. So because of that, I have felt a calling to extend Krishna consciousness to persons like myself, college students that don't know up from down and left from right and anything from nothing. At least give the opportunity to contact Krishna consciousness. That's the opportunity. So something that I've noticed, I'll just give a little, there was a period of time when young Americans were very interested in Krishna consciousness. And then there was a period of time when the very same poster that we put up on the college campus, young American kids didn't show up. It was 90% non-resident Indian students, and that was for about a decade. Now it's very different. Now it's a big mix. Same posters, same university, same everything. There's a very different response. Young Americans are now once again interested in spiritual inquiry. Like just interested. I could give examples, but it's a phenomenon. It's a very, very good time for giving Krishna consciousness to young Americans. Not only on the college campus, but wherever there's young Americans. Like our devotees that go and distribute books at concerts. Huge receptivity. Not just they buy the books, but they're very interested. So, there's another group that's also increasing exponentially, and that's Chinese students. The percentage of Chinese students in America is rapidly on the increase. Just at, you know, the University of Illinois, 40,000 students, 10% of them are from China. And Illinois Institute of Technology, 70% of the student population is foreign students, and 50% of that 70% are Chinese. And UCLA, I don't know what the statistic is, but just walking around campus, huge. I mean, there's more Chinese than there are trees. But to speak of, you know, American students, they're all over the place. Huge. So the demographics of America are changing. Now, many of those Chinese students go back to China because they like their country and they want to help their country. They're a strong national spirit. Many don't. They want to stay here. But many want to go back. So I have met a number of Chinese students in the course of speaking at colleges where they have, they're familiar with Buddhism. And in Buddhism, if they're familiar with spirituality at all, it's Buddhism. And they want to know, when they find out that Buddha is found in the Bhagavatam, they want to know what's the connection, Buddha and Krishna. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time with you. It connects to the purport, you know, impersonalism and voidism, where a question that was asked of me, and this now, this goes to China, because I've been visiting China also in the course of the last 4 years. I was chairman of the GBC 1 year. I'm glad, was glad when it was over. But when I was chairman, I thought, what's a chairman supposed to do? Nobody told me. I didn't get any training, no briefing, no preparation, just like, good luck. So I thought, chairman should think, look at the world and what's important in the world. So I, you know, thought China's important in the world, 1/4 of the world's population. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj has recently left the world and he was the GBC that started the China mission. And the other GBC, his name is Chandrasekhar, and he's blacklisted, he can't go into China. So they don't have any association, 1/4 of the world's population from the GBC side. So I should go as a chairman and just say, you people are important. So I did. And I, you know, it was a nice experience. They're not only, the place is important, the devotees are very wonderful and they need association. So I committed to continue to go there. And one of the things that I understood was, you know, the government makes preaching a little difficult for different reasons. So something that would really help the China mission is if the students who are coming here in increasing numbers, if we could get easy access to them while they're here, help them understand Krishna consciousness while they're here and they go back, they can help the China mission when they go back. I guess, you know, it's 2 + 2 = 4. It's really easy. So I've been spending some time trying to help Chinese students understand bhakti yoga. And, you know, initially, Chinese people are really warm, really friendly, really like easy to relate to. But when it comes to spiritual topics, it's a little difficult, I've found. And part of the difficulty is when it comes to spirituality, there's not really a conception of a personal God. There's a conception of Buddha. So, like somebody asked me, now I'm getting down to this purport, and Krishna has a spiritual abode in the spiritual world called Krishna Loka. What's Buddha's abode? Is there also a Buddha planet in the spiritual world? I'd never read anything about a Buddha planet in the spiritual world, so I didn't even know how to go about it. So then I started, looking at Rupa Goswami's writings and Prabhupada's writings and researching the subject. In the course of that, doing that, I decided I wanted to put together a presentation for Chinese students that says, this is the conception of Buddha that's prevalent in China today. Of course, there's all varieties. And this is the Vedic conception of Buddha, and then this is the position of Krishna and Bhakti. So it turns out that Tamal Krishna Maharaj, when he went back to school at SMU, he wrote an essay on something unusual happened on the road to Nirvana, which I'm going to describe. So one of the most prominent, are you from China, Mataji?
No, I'm from Cambodia.
Well, maybe you'll be able to relate to this, just the conception of Buddhism that's prevalent in China today.
They follow Mahayana.
Mahayana Buddhism.
For me, it's Theravada.
It's different.
Yes.
Different version.
For us, it's more in Bali, and there's more Sanskrit.
Okay. Well, here's the study that I've done so far. There's a term, because I asked Nrisimha Maharaj, who has been preaching, he's a sannyasi, Prabhupada disciple, preaching in China for a couple of decades. So I said, surely you must have run into this question. How do you respond to this question? He said, I am not really a scholar, but I know that in China they have this idea. He gave the Chinese term, and it's an abode where it's called the land of bliss, or the western land of bliss, or something like that. Where if you're an ardent follower of Buddha, you go to that place. But then you study it further, and it's a place where it's still in the material world, and there's a form of Buddha. I guess there's different forms of Buddha. There's a form of Buddha in that place. And then they train you to go to the next place. And you know what the next place is? Nothingness. Nirvana, where the concept is from somethingness to nothingness. And actually, there's nothingness. That's all there is. And what's over here, when we think there's somethingness, it's illusion. And if you become an effective, like a qualified follower of Buddhism, you go to this land of bliss where you get trained up to enter the land of nothingness. Does that make sense? Because that's the goal. When we have our pranam mantra, nirvishesha shunyavadi paschacha desha tarine. How prevalent is Buddhism today? Well, it's one of the fastest growing religions in the world, and one of the reasons is that you don't make a commitment to a person, a personal God. You just, the teaching, if you're following it, is nonviolence, ahimsa, nonviolence. And notes, I've literatures that I've read, just like very quick scan of it, like in big bold print, that the perfection of religion is ahimsa. Now, what our teaching says, the perfection of religion, sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam sharanam braja, surrendering unto Krishna. Just like Prabhupada is writing in his purport, as we offer our pranam mantra, he's making it very clear the meditation that was being done by Kardama Muni was not on something void or something impersonal, nor was the form of the Lord imaginary, as the impersonalists say it is. But it's authentic, it's genuine. He was actually experiencing the personality of Godhead. Now, if you don't have that, what do you have? You have impersonalism or voidism. You follow the path of goodness, just like, just like the Western, or say American perspective of religion. I can tell you, because I travel a lot, and when I travel, I'm dressed like this, and people see, and some are curious and don't say, and some are curious and say. And those that are curious and say, the initial is, do you mind if I ask you a personal question about your religion? So, no. The next question is, are you a Buddhist monk? And I say, no, I'm a Krishna monk. And they go, oh, what's a Krishna monk? Then I have a chance to say something about Krishna without, and it's just curiosity. They don't really want to know. So, Buddhism is very popular. But the wish is to become good, and then from becoming good, you go to the good place, and from the good place, you go to the place of nothingness. Nirvana, or Nirvishesh, Shunya, the place of Shunya, nothing. That's the goal. Because their understanding is that's not it's a goal, because that's reality. Reality is there's nothing. Little oxygen, please. It's how do you get inspired to go to a place of nothingness? That's the travel brochure. Go to the place of nothingness. And before you go there, you go to the place of bliss. But after that, you go to the place of nothingness. It's beyond bliss. Let me just finish this. And the Christian conception is, you should be good. Oh, I was going to say, when people, they say, oh, you're a Krishna monk, could you tell, what are your basic beliefs? And I've done this enough times that I know that people are tuned out. They don't hear what I say. Because I say whatever I say, and then they say, oh, that's very much like my religion. I also believe that you should be nice, don't hurt anybody, and believe in God. That's not at all what I said, but that's what they heard. So, the mode of goodness, to go to the good place, heaven, the place of bliss, where it's very nice. Ask them, I've done it. Ask them what heaven is. What's it like? They don't know. When I was little, I asked my priest and my parents and a bunch of people, Sunday school teacher, and what's heaven? What's it like there? I'm supposed to want to go there. What's it like there? No answer. Because they don't know. It's it's the place of bliss. So, but what's the ultimate? What's the goal? The Bhagavatam is making very clear, and especially by the agency of our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada in his purports, he's making it very clear. The goal is love of God. And when love of God is there, there's a person. It's not nothingness. It's not in-person. It's a person. And there's a reciprocation of love with a supreme, sublime person. The position of service to that person. Using our senses in the service of the master of the senses. That's the goal. And one can achieve that if you have a clear sense of goal. So I'm learning the art of, with Chinese students, because that's kind of like I've adopted that sector of the student population to try to help the China mission, and there's so many of them, to help them go from nothingness to somethingness to a person. And I can tell you, it's difficult. They say it's very difficult. They like prasadam. They like vegetarianism. They like even the idea of you're not this body, although, you know, what you are if you're not this body isn't so clear to them. I mean, spirit soul. Concept of spirit soul. That's a quantum step. But then the supreme person, that's like a mega step. But once that is understood, same for us, once it's understood, it makes the path of progress in Krishna consciousness very easy, or let's say direct. You can rise above the struggles of the modes of nature and obstacles on the path of devotion once the goal is very clear, because Krishna will carry you to the goal. How can the yogis do what they do without having taken shelter in the super soul, and then ultimately the supreme person? It's not on one's own strength. It's not possible. I mean, you could say it 10 times. It's not possible. Not possible to do that on your own. It's possible through the agency of descending mercy, along with, you know, a sincere effort to perform the process of bhakti properly. Descending mercy is necessary. So, I guess tomorrow I'll speak a little bit more about, there's now going to be an exchange between not only the Lord smiles, but he speaks. And Kardamuni speaks to him, and he speaks to Kardamuni, and there's this wonderful exchange between the two. Because the Lord has some service for him, his devotee. And that service keeps him connected through the medium of service. The connection continues. So we're going to hear about their discussion tomorrow. Any comments or questions? Yes?
Did you say that you were going to talk about where Buddha was mentioned?
I don't know if I did, but I could.
Could you, like, just...
Buddha is mentioned... In Canto 1, Chapter 3, there's a verse, because in Chapter 1 of Canto 1, there's some questions. One of those questions is, Sutta, can you describe the forms of the Lord as they appear in this world? So he obliges that question by giving a list of some of the avatars. And one in that list is Lord Buddha. And Lord Buddha is spoken of in the future tense. The verb is future tense. He will appear. And it tells what family, what his mother's name will be, what province he'll appear in, and what he'll do before he appears. The Buddha is an incarnation, an avatar of Krishna, who appears in this world for a specific purpose. And the purpose is also identified. So you can look it up. First Canto, Chapter 3. Then it's again spoken of very briefly in Second Canto. And I forget if it's Chapter 7 or 8, something like that. There's another list of avatars or forms of the Lord that appear. Okay? You had something? You had something.
Yes, I have two questions.
Two questions. I'm going to repeat because it's got a soft voice.
So the first question would be pertaining to you mentioning that, you know, in order to get a child, one needs to be qualified.
In order to have a qualified child, one must be qualified.
One must be qualified.
You can be an animal and have a child.
Yes. So, and everything in Srimad Bhagavatam is very precise. The duration of life of Brahma.
Everything in Bhagavatam is precise.
Okay, and now... So the process for begetting a child, one has to become spiritually enlightened.
one has to become spiritually enlightened to beget a spiritually enlightened child.
And now the question comes to mind is that what is the time definition in which that qualification would be?
What's the time definition? There's no time definition. Some take shorter, some take longer, some never make it.
For the qualification?
Yeah. It's not a time duration qualification. It's a qualification.
Based on service rendered.
Based on submission. And through that submission, purification. It's like, okay, here's a wet log. There's a fire. I can place the wet log right next to the fire. I can place it 2 miles from the fire, or somewhere in between. And to proportionate to where I place it near the fire is going to become dry. And then it can be put in the fire and ignite.
So what is the revelation? Where does the revelation come from that now the qualification has been achieved and that you're ready for
it? Your question is, what's the revelation? And I would rephrase it and say, by what qualities can one know that someone is qualified? That question is asked 4 times in Bhagavad Gita. I can refer you to those sections of Bhagavad Gita. But if one of them comes at the end of chapter 14, where one is beyond the modes of material nature. The symptoms are understood. There's another place where Arjuna asks, how does the self-realized soul sit? How do they walk? How do they speak? That's another section. Or in chapter 12, after describing the different categories of, you know, higher and lower positions of perfection, and if you can't do that, do that, do that, Krishna describes those who are very dear to him. He describes the qualities. So there are symptoms by which one can understand, objectively and subjectively. Okay. And just read those sections.
Yeah, yeah. So just a very fine question on that as well. So the qualities are there, and one, the reader will be able to read it, but the identifier of those symptoms in the person who is doing that, going to undertake that service, will the person himself identify those qualities in himself, or is it...
So that's, let me do your question in a different way. There's subjective, just like, let's say, in the workplace. There may be self-evaluation, peer evaluation, and a 360. Spiritual qualification can also be self-evaluation, peer evaluation, and, you know, an assembly of Vaishnavas do evaluation. How am I doing? All three have their place. Self-evaluation is certainly, one can understand, here's Bhaktivinoda Thakur, a very, very simple litmus test. One can tell if one is becoming advanced, if one's attraction for material objects in the mood of enjoying them slackens. Just slackens. Or there's a verse in the Bhagavatam, Bhakti Parishano Bhava Viraktiranyatra Cha. You know that one. Those are 3 symptoms. And one can know from those symptoms, subjectively, self-evaluation is part of the bhakti process. Then objectively someone can see similarly. So both have their place. So your question is, can one know? Yes, one can know. And what are the symptoms? These are some of the symptoms by which one can know. Here's another one. Calamity comes. Pow! Where does your mind go? That's a very good test. Because your mind goes where that place of shelter is. Very, very, very instructive. Watch and see where your mind goes. That's where your attachments are. Something else? Yes. A little louder. The kids are louder than you are.
What qualification Hiranyakashipu and Kayadu had for such, they had such a wonderful child like Prahlad Maharaj?
That was part of the plan of the Lord. It wasn't like special qualifications that they had. It's the anomaly. It's the exception to the rule. The Lord had a plan. Something else? Yes?
I have a personal question. I feel happy when I believe that Krishna is watching over us and everything will be good in my life.
But for about
2 months, I started doing 16 rounds and I have this recurring feeling that life is full of miseries and there is no guarantee that good things would happen. And I don't know how to get out of this thought. It makes me feel sad. Can you suggest something I can think while I'm doing my rounds? Because it doesn't happen throughout the day. I do my rounds when I'm in max, so I really cannot listen to myself. And I constantly have this feeling that, you know, life is full of miseries and I don't know how to get around that. It just makes me feel sad.
Well, a few things. It's one thing to look through that lens as knowledge, jnana chakshusha. You know the phrase? Chakshusha, seeing through knowledge, or shastra chakshusha. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says what you just said, but that's looking at through the lens of knowledge. And the other is the mind. So they're different. The knowledge is to allow you to discern this from that. Like, is this happiness or is this suffering? A person, let's say, an alcoholic, when they see alcohol, that's happiness. A person who's looking at the same thing through the eye of knowledge sees it as, you know, something that leads one's consciousness down. It's the very source of suffering. But so that's reality. But then supposing I'm the alcoholic again. I'm addicted to this alcohol and I know what's ruining my life. So it's misery, but I'm addicted to it. That's the modes of nature acting on the mind. It's not mode of goodness, seeing things through knowledge. So one suggestion for you, because you're looking for a suggestion, read along with your chanting. Read and become familiar with Bhagavad Gita and then see the world essentially as Krishna sees the world. You see as Krishna sees. Not that you become Krishna, but you see as Krishna sees. And by design, he says, Dukkhalayam Ashashvatam. This world has been designed that way. And there's a purpose behind the design. It's to help us understand we don't belong here. Are you a mother?
No.
Right. Those that mothers that have children, they sometimes have to discipline their children. The child wants to do something. And the parents, when they see that it's not good for the child to do that something, they'll say no. And where will the child go? Why are you giving me this misery? And the answer is, because it's not helpful for you. It's detrimental for you. It's not misery. I'm keeping you from misery. That's another way to look at the situation. The design of the material world is to teach us the lesson that we don't belong here. But at the same time, within that creation, chapter 3 Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he gives the means at the same time to connect with our original consciousness by the process of yajna or sacrifice. So here I am in this world that's a place where there is suffering that goes on. But at the same time, there's this enormous kindness that Krishna is giving to connect again with him and not only go back to him, but make this a more conducive atmosphere for others to also go back to him. Be an instrument of his while in this place. Krishna is very kind. So, that's like seeing with your heart instead of seeing with the mind. So see with the lens of knowledge or scripture, and then go to the position of heart, where the holy name is given to you, and all the other processes of bhakti are given to you, not just like to all of us, but you know, given to you to elevate the soul to its natural position once again. Krishna is very kind. There's a place of darkness, and into this place of darkness, Krishna has personally come to lead me out of the place of darkness that I chose to come to. I don't belong here. Krishna advised me not to come here. I was insistent, very stubbornly insistent, and here I am. And it's not a nice place. I don't belong here. I want to go to Krishna, and he's giving me the means. Although I turned my back on him and said, see you later. He didn't abandon me. I abandoned him. And now Krishna is still very kind. He's taking me. He's giving me the opportunity to again come to him. Krishna is very kind. That's the heart. Okay? Well, let's just see if there's someone else. And then not. Someone else would like to... something? Okay, you're on.
Thank you, Maharaj. So, Buddhism, like you mentioned, from somethingness to nothingness to voidism, whereas we, from nothingness... there's a person. So at the end, there is a person in us. So it seems like that when you are preaching to the Buddhist people, the philosophy is being told to them that they see it in a reverse way. That there is a person where they believe that there is nothing at the end. So, Buddha himself, Krishna, came as Buddha and he preached this.
I'll give you a rerun of his question. It's a long question.
So Krishna came as Buddha and he established this philosophy that the Buddhists are now following. And again, you know, Krishna himself declares that he's a person. So how do the Buddhists, you know, when we are preaching to them, to make them understand, like as you mentioned, it's very tough to explain to them at times. And so will we ever arrive at, you know, they might see that the Hare Krishna movement is like finishing of the Buddhism, so to speak, because there will be a person at the end, whereas for them there is nothing in the end. So do they see us as rivals too, in some ways?
His question is, since Krishna consciousness teaches at the end there's a person, and Buddhism teaches at the end there's nothingness, when we're presenting Krishna consciousness to the Buddhists, do they see this as a challenge or a confrontation, or like against their convictions, their beliefs?
As a threat.
As a threat to their beliefs. Maybe somebody that's deeply invested might see it like that. But very, very, very rare are people deeply invested in anything except sense gratification. So... it's just another interesting thing, along with another interesting thing, along with another interesting thing. That's my experience. They don't feel threatened by it. But they want to know, it's not like exactly they want to get their mind around the concept, but they want to know, is this real? And they have a problem with both. Conceptually, and also conviction. And as with my, just going one step further, my experience with them, as well as with anyone else, a big part of helping them become convinced is the relationship that you have with them. And the qualities that you exhibit when you're with them and around, you know, interacting with other people. They see the qualities. And they, you know, they, because they're soft-hearted people, they feel this is a good person. So it engenders trust because of the goodness they see in the qualities of the person and the care of the person for them. They're guarded. It's an interesting thing. part of the culture that I've experienced is there's something behind always, and they don't show the something behind. They show a nice face, and there's something behind, and they don't show. It's just cultural, not just in relation to Krishna consciousness. It's cultural. And it's not so easy that they let people inside to what's going on inside. And that's kind of like layers and layers and layers of trust and like not trust. And, you know, just something else is in... Anyway, so the more part of this thing of saying, you know, Buddhism and Krishna, like Christ and Krishna, for Christians, for Buddhism, or Buddha and Krishna, for Buddhists. How do Buddhists think? How do devotees of Krishna think about Buddha? And what's the position of Krishna? So that's ideology or philosophy. And it's important to have that. You have to know the goal is a person, not nothingness. But the willingness of people to go to somethingness instead of nothingness, or person instead of nothingness, is the trust in the relationship and the qualities. That what speaks louder than words is the qualities of a devotee to help a person move to the house of bhakti, into the to the realm of devotional service, accepting and practicing. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Prabhupada ki.
His Holiness Prabhupada Swami Maharaj ki.
Jai.